Hey there, Rick Sengary of Vermont Edition. Just want you to know this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Peter Welch has been serving as Vermont's sole representative in the U.S. House for nearly 12 years. He'd like your vote again as he runs for a seventh term. He's facing off against two challengers, Dan Freilich and Ben Mitchell, in Vermont's Democratic primary on August 14th. Vermont Edition has been interviewing candidates running contested statewide and federal campaigns all summer, and today we are joined by Congressman Welch. He trained as a lawyer and has been in Vermont politics since 1980. Welch lives in Norwich. Welcome back to the program, Representative Welch.
Thank you.
So we were just talking about the nurses' strike, and we got a note from Len in Essex who says, "I have not come across any public comments of yours about the UVM nurses' strike. Can you share your thoughts, please?"
I hope it's resolved. I mean, it's critical to all of us to have that resolved, and I hope it will be resolved at the bargaining table. The nurses are critical. They need a raise. They're fighting for a raise, and my strong hope is that this is going to get worked out between the folks at the bargaining table.
But you're not willing to take a position. Several candidates running for office, and as we've heard, Bernie Sanders, have taken positions siding with the nurses.
Well, I'm very sympathetic with the nurses, and I hope they get what they want. But this has to be resolved by the folks at the table. And having a mediator, I think, would be very, very helpful. You know, at the end of the day, it's the people in the room who are really going to be affected. And I definitely am supportive of the concerns of the nurses, them getting fair pay. We really depend on them. And my hope is the administrators at the hospital, with the benefit of a mediator, are going to be able to come to a resolution.
Since we're talking about health care, let's look at some of your positions on health care and some of the things that you advocate for. You would like to lower prescription drug costs for Americans by having the federal government negotiate discounts in bulk pricing. As you know, the Vermont legislature has asked AHS Secretary Alex Azar for permission to import some drugs from Canada, and it doesn't seem like that could be a very viable 50-state solution. So what is it that you would like to see in terms of how the federal government could negotiate lower prescription drug costs?
Well, the only thing that can really work is to have the federal government take a role on behalf of consumers. The prescription drug price increases have been relentless, and it's putting it out of reach. You know, pharma comes up with some medications that help cure disease and alleviate pain, but they're killing us with the price increases. It's the fastest-growing component of the healthcare industry. And essentially what we have to do is, number one, there should be price negotiation. When Medicare Part D was passed, it did provide a prescription drug benefit. Pharma got a legal provision saying that it was improper, prohibiting price negotiation. So it would be as though you're going into a store to buy 100 aspirin and you pay the same per unit cost as if you're buying 10. It makes no sense. So price negotiation. Importation actually would be a good thing to do because, in fact, a lot of the prescription drugs that we buy in this country are manufactured abroad, and we have FDA regulators over there and inspectors making certain that things are safe. It's something President Trump said he'd support. And then third, the market is really broken. The drug companies get a period of exclusivity, and they have monopoly pricing power, and they've been abusing that by extending it, by stopping generics from coming online. And then the other thing that they do is they buy a company that has a cheap and affordable prescription drug, and then they boost the price relentlessly. So this is an incredible challenge for taxpayers, for employers who are providing health care to their workers, and also to individuals where co-pays and deductibles are just hammering them.
You know, you don't have a ton of great, nice, supportive things to say about the president, but didn't President Trump just get Pfizer to roll back a price increase that it was planning to do later this summer?
He did, and I'm glad he did. But we need much more than that. It can't be a one-off where he talks to a company on a particular drug, but the overall system continues to be passing on rip-off prices. And in fact, as you may know, Elijah Cummings, a member of Congress who I work with on prescription drug price negotiation, he and I were invited to the White House in March of last year, or April of last year, and the president said all the right things about price negotiation, about importation, but then he's done nothing. So what he did with Pfizer, that's good.
On Twitter, I think it was a Twitter diss. And
okay. But it's not a systemic approach across the board. You know, we have the highest pharma prices in this country of any place in the world. And it's a major, major problem on affordability of health care. So the president has to have public policy as opposed to just a one-off Twitter attack on one particular drug.
On your campaign website, you also say that you'd really like the government to develop generic alternatives to expensive brand drugs. And that's the phrasing that you use, the government to develop. Hasn't that been a problem? I mean, the government has cut funding for R&D over the last few decades for research organizations. And given the time it takes a drug to go into development and then for blockbuster drugs to come off patent and for a generic alternative to be there, not to mention how things work with for-profit drug companies versus nonprofit researchers, how do you see the government investing in developing these generic alternatives?
Well, that's why we need funding for the National Institute of Health. You know, the pharma companies oftentimes claim that they put an immense amount of money into research. In fact, it's taxpayers that put an immense amount of money into research. And we've been cutting that budget. And fortunately, we've been able to get some increases in NIH funding. The other thing that's really important is to note that the pharma companies spend much more on advertising than they do on research and development. And they spend a lot of time in litigation trying to stop generics from coming online.
But they're businesses. I mean, they are for-profit businesses.
You know what? That's exactly right. But what is unique in this country is that the government here does not do anything to help the consumer. It lets the private market pharma folks do whatever it is they want. So when they're messing around extending the life of a patent, the government stands on the sidelines. When they buy a company and then boost the prices, there's no antitrust consequences. When they keep generics off the market, there's no penalty for that. So you expect a private company is going to do what it can do, but you should have an expectation as a citizen that your government is going to step in where there's ripoff practices and anti-competitive practices. And the government has been very passive when it comes to addressing the ripoff practices that are endemic in the pharma industry.
So really, you'd like to see the federal government play a bigger role or have a heavier hand in many aspects of that that negotiation on healthcare and particularly on prescription drugs, whether it's pricing or dealing with bad business practices.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the government has to play a role or consumers are going to continue to get ripped off. There's no restraint in the pharma industry. I mean, you look at something like companies, it's Wall Street actually pushing a lot of this. They see that if a company has a particular medication, they'll raise the money to buy that company, and then they'll pay back the money they borrowed by boosting the price and having employers, having individuals, and having taxpayers have to pick up the tab for the purchase of that company and that drug. They have incredible pricing power with no restraint.
You'd also like to see us go to a Medicare for All system of health care insurance. How would that work?
Well, Medicare, it works like Medicare.
Right.
I mean, essentially, Medicare right now is a very popular health care program, and thank goodness we have it, because everyone up 65 and older has some security that they'll have access to the health care that they need when they need it and with the doctor or hospital of their choice. And it's very popular and supported, so there's no mystery to it. And ultimately, I'd like to see us have a system in this country where that type of access to healthcare was available to every one of our citizens. And every other industrialized country has that. We're the only ones that don't. So I support Medicare for All. It's an incredible political challenge. We saw that in Vermont. But one of the, I think, practical steps we could definitely take is to expand the opportunity for people to buy into Medicare once they reach the age of 50. So if you could take steps to get to a Medicare for All situation, that I think would be very popular. And I'm going to be pushing very hard, especially in a new Congress, for Medicare buy-in at age 50, which would be good for individuals, but also good for employers. They'd be able to substitute what they're purchasing in the private market where prices are going up for a Medicare plan.
So age 50 now is what you'd advocate for, and then 40, then 30? I mean, would it be sort of a step-down approach, essentially?
We've got to get there. I mean, the transition from the system that we have to a system that is universal is a hard process. I mean, we even see that with the Affordable Care Act. It's hard in the practical implementation steps that have to be taken, and it's very hard in the political steps that have to be taken and building support for it. You know, we passed the Affordable Care Act. It helped bring down costs. It increased access to about 24 million people. It was a constructive step, the first big step we've taken since the passage of Medicare and Medicaid. But then there was an enormous political reaction to it, where for the next several years until President Trump got elected, on the floor of the House, 65 times we voted, quote, to repeal health care. And then when the Republicans had Trump and their majority this past year, they tried to repeal and, quote, repeal and replace, and they had no replacement. But the efforts since then have been to sabotage what we have. It's very, very damaging. So this is a challenge, even in the best of times. But what I'm seeing about healthcare is that the cost is going up relentlessly. And it's really tough on our employers who want to provide coverage for their employees. It's really tough on individuals if they have to get their own insurance. And it's really tough on co-pays and deductibles. And we spend the most on healthcare in this country by a significant amount, and have comparable results or lesser results than many other countries that do spend a lot less. So there's a lot to focus on, particularly on the cost side.
Paul in Barrytown wants to know, if reelected, will you support Nancy Pelosi for leader?
My question on who our leader is going to be is based on how we lead, not who the leader is. And that's going to be a very lively debate. If we're lucky enough to get the majority back, then one of the biggest challenges we face is, as Democrats, is to make this institution work. And the question I'm going to have for anybody who offers themselves for leadership is, will you commit yourself to decentralizing power, taking it out of the Speaker's office and putting it back into our committees? You know, when I was in Vermont, our committees had a lot of responsibility, and Republicans and Democrats would have to argue out the issues and come to some resolution. And leadership would be supportive. I was the Senate leader. And oftentimes on jump ball type questions, I'd weigh in. But what's happened in the House, and this is what I've seen during the time I've been here, is that all the decisions are now being made in the Speaker's office, and it politicizes everything, and it creates an immense amount of frustration as to whether any of this legislation is on the level. So my advocacy within the Democratic caucus is that we as a caucus, and for anyone who wants to lead the caucus, has to commit themselves to decentralizing power and restoring power to the committees.
Don't you know enough about Nancy Pelosi to determine already whether or not she's someone you can support in that endeavor?
This is a whole new debate for us. I mean, first of all, I have a lot of respect for what Nancy Pelosi's done. I mean, we wouldn't have had the Affordable Health Care Act without her. She's a very skillful politician. But what I'm seeing here is a good deal of frustration about how broken the institution is. And I believe it's absolutely essential for the Democrats to have a family discussion about what we expect, whether it's Pelosi or anybody else.
But Paul's follow-up is, if yes, why isn't it time for new leadership, especially if the Democrats do not take over the House? So Paul is trying to determine part of his vote based on, you know, whether or not you support Nancy Pelosi.
We have to make this work for the American people. I mean, you know, Nancy Pelosi is an issue, and she's very controversial, especially in these races. And many of the new candidates are taking a pledge that they're not going to vote for her. She's becoming a symbol for many people as to how they'll vote. I'm here, and my goal, and I think this is what's the long-term importance of what we do, is how we lead. It's, do we make this institution work? Whether Pelosi's going to offer herself for leadership or not, whether she's going to have the votes with all these new candidates basically saying they won't support her, that's an open question. So I haven't answered it, so I can't give Paul that, quote, definitive answer, but I can tell him that I will not support any person, whether it's Pelosi or anyone else, who isn't fully committed to what I think is the most important question, and that is having our committees be empowered and not have everything concentrated in the Speaker's office.
We got a note from Bill in Woodstock who says, one of your two challengers, Dr. Dan Frylich, has promised to withdraw from the race if you decide to no longer accept financial contributions from corporations and special interest groups. Why not accept his offer and increase your chance of reelection? Although it is not illegal to accept such funding, it is also not a requirement in order to be successful. Grassroots-funded campaigns are finding success in political arenas across the nation. So why continue to do so?
Well, two things. First of all, Dan and Ben both are free to run their campaigns as they see fit. But number two, the question of financing in campaigns and the amount of money in campaigns, that's a very important question. It's been a concern of mine since I served in the state Senate. And what I would ideally see us doing is having a public financing system that put limits on how much could be spent in campaigns. But the world right now has really changed ever since Citizens United. Because aside from political action committee money, whether it's a corporate PAC or an environmental PAC or labor PAC, there are limitations on how much a political action committee or individual can contribute. There's no limit on what the dark money can be contributed to a campaign. And what's happened in this last election after Citizens United, it was $1.8 billion spent in campaigns, incredible amount of money. But $1 billion of that was contributed by 100 people in this country. They are owning the political system. And what that also means is that there are some of those 100 people who have political advisors. They're surveying all 435 House races and all 100 Senate races, trying to figure out where they can come in and take it over. So I raise money under the current campaign finance law. It's all disclosed, every dollar I get, every dime I spend, and I do it so that I can, A, run a race, and B, prepared for when that avalanche of money comes in. And I'm someone who could easily be a target because I have been very aggressive in fighting big pharma, fighting the big banks, fossil fuels, and the credit cards. So that challenge of campaign finance, I think, has really been significantly intensified by Citizens United in the dark money that is vast, and it exceeds all the other contributions that are coming in.
But assuming you were to win the Democratic primary in August, the two Republicans who are running in the Republican primary are Brooke Page and Anya Tinio, neither of whom have raised a significant amount of money. It doesn't seem like that dark money juggernaut is funneling money into their campaigns to try to defeat you. So, you know, it's not like you're up against a huge amount of money on the Republican side come the general election.
That's true. That's true right now. But what I've seen, and it's just is happening all around the country, is that when and if that dark money sees an opportunity, it comes in with an avalanche of money at the end of the race. So this is about being prepared as much as it is about the particular moment that we're in right now. And by the way, one of the things that is really sad about this, when I first ran for Congress, it was the first time there was an open seat in 16 years. And as you may remember, there was an excellent Republican candidate, Martha Rainville, and she raised and spent over $2 million. I did the same. She and I had a handshake that we wouldn't run a negative ad in that campaign. It turned out that was the only contested race for Congress in the country with no negative ads. And I think it may well be the last one where there's been no negative ads. Because of Citizens United, if Martha and I were running against each other again and we tried to make that agreement, we couldn't enforce it because the Koch brothers or who take your pick would be able to come in and flood the airwaves with negative ads that would poison the atmosphere. So this is a new world, and all of us who were in Congress have to be prepared to defend ourselves in the event that that dark money decides to land in the state of Vermont.
The first thing that you list among your priorities in office on your campaign website is to pass a comprehensive climate change bill that makes significant investments in energy efficiency and renewable energy. Dee in Sharon writes, climate change is here and now, costing millions in property damage and economic disruption, creating international climate refugees and conflicts over food and water resources, causing species migration and extinction, and basically threatening the world order and the survivability of the human race. Many of us feel helpless. What can you offer to assure Vermonters that you are doing everything in your power and more to fight for sane environmental policies?
Well, I agree with her, and it's just absolutely appalling that we had, as the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, a guy who did everything he could to accelerate climate change, and that's Scott Pruitt, and good riddance to him. It's terrible that the president is embracing coal as though that's an answer and is acting as though there is no such thing as climate change. So we have an enormous problem in Congress with the current leadership. But there's two things here that we can do on a practical level. Energy efficiency is the one area where I've gotten significant support from some of my Republican colleagues. And when we passed in the House, when the Democrats were in the majority, the climate change bill that would have reduced emissions by 80% by 2050, 40% of the carbon emission reductions were going to come through efficiency. And that was the part of the bill that I sponsored. And I'm continuing to make some progress with my colleagues on efficiency, so we've got to keep at it. Secondly, I'm part of a climate caucus that does have some Republicans in it because they get it. And then third, what I'm seeing is that companies are playing a major role in efficiency, and it's two reasons. One, many of those companies are hearing from our caller that they want clean energy being used. And number two, they're seeing that if you take on the challenge of creating an energy-efficient economy, battery storage technology, that what you're going to do is create jobs and save money. So there is what's mystifying to me about colleagues here who are opposed to taking steps to address climate change is not just that they're letting a bad problem get worse, but they're squandering the opportunity to create jobs in a stronger economy that will occur if we take on the challenge before us.
Let's go to Kyle, who's calling in from Waterville. Hi, Kyle. Go right ahead.
Hi. I actually have kind of a follow-up that was just in relation to the campaign finance stuff. And it's essentially that the answer that we're hearing for that question of why wouldn't you stop taking PAC money is because it will help me win. And if you get a deluge of dark money, you want to be able to fight it. But what it sounds like to someone like me who is supportive of Bernie Sanders and thinks that candidates are able to run races without taking PAC money is that you're willing to compromise your principles on Citizens United in order to stay in office.
Well, I don't compromise my principles on anything. You know, money in politics is a legitimate concern, and that's why I think it's so important to be transparent. And all my contributions are publicly reported, as are all my expenditures. The dark money, which I don't get, obviously a secret, and you don't know who gets it and where it's spent or how. But bottom line here is that any of us who serve in public office have to be willing to make the decision I've made, which is that every decision I make with respect to a vote is based on A, is it good for Vermont, B, is it good for the country. And then you get to review my record to see if I'm consistent in how I'm voting and whether you think it makes sense or it doesn't. And that's the benefit of the transparency of contributions, expenditures, and also my voting record.
Kyle, does that satisfy you?
Yeah. Well, I understand, and I really appreciate all the service you've done for us, and I love all the decisions you make and the votes that you make. But as a voter, the fact that there is an option of not taking money from corporate PACs and that, and seeing that you do, then that we don't know if there's decisions outside of the voting record, if there's a bill you would have brought up if you didn't take that money from a PAC. Those are the type of things we don't know. And when there's an option to not take that money, even if it's disclosed, I think transparency is very important, too. It's just very concerning and one of the bigger issues that I'm planning on voting on this year. Mm-hmm.
Kyle, thanks for your comments. Representative Welch, care to say anything else?
No, I thank him. And I think his concern is my concern about money in politics. And you can have a situation where somebody takes a political action committee contribution from a labor union, from an environmental union. That is limited on how much you can take. But you can have some folks who don't take say, a financial institution political action committee, but gets hundreds of thousands of dollars from individuals who are in the financial sector. And it would, I think, raise the same questions. So there's always a question about what influence money has in politics. And the bottom line here is that the less reliance there is on fundraising, the more I think people can have confidence that money's not really the reason for the legislation. And it's why I think ultimately having a public finance system, actually a public financing system, makes sense.
Representative Welch, you recently visited the southern border to look at some of the Trump policies that have raised so much attention, so much anger in many parts of the country. You also voted against Republican-led measures in the House on immigration. What would be your approach to changing immigration policy in the U.S.?
Well, first of all, I do want to talk about the southern border because that was appalling. I mean, it was atrocious. There were two reactions I had. One, heartbreaking, because I met mothers and fathers who didn't know where their kids were. I met children who didn't know where their parents were in one cage. And these really are cages, chain link fences in a warehouse. I saw that are very cold. They have air conditioning on. It's really hot outside, but cold inside. I saw three, they must have been brothers, lying on these thin mattresses in a spoon size. Spooning in a way, holding on to each other for dear life. And it's heartbreaking. And we talked to 10 mothers, each of whom had a story about coming from Honduras or Guatemala or El Salvador, each of whom had been threatened with violence, one of whom had a 13-year-old daughter. And on the way up, the mother was scared about whether she'd be able to make it and wanted to go back. And the 13-year-old daughter says, "Mom, they'll kill me if we go back." And we have made the president's, quote, zero tolerance policy was essentially a euphemism for allowing the separation of parents from kids. That woman whose 13-year-old daughter encouraged her to try to cross the border, the mother didn't know where she was. And that's heartbreaking. Every one of us identifies with that, Republicans and Democrats, by the way. But the second thing that really was disturbing is that this policy was being done in our name. In the name of our government, your government and my government. And the president was quite explicit in why he did this. He said, number one, he wanted to send a deterrent message to the potential asylum seekers, and as though those people who were so desperate and so fearful would be persuaded by his, quote, deterrent. But the second thing he said is that he wanted this to be leverage in Congress to get people like me to give him $25 billion for his wall. So essentially what he's done is put innocent children in the way as a negotiating tactic to try to get his version of what border security is. And I find that really, really objectionable. Now, what we should do, we should have a bipartisan bill, much like the Senate passed. You know, Senator Leahy played a big role in that. But you'd have border security, not necessarily a wall, but security. You would have a path to citizenship for people who are here, and that's not amnesty. That's the buzzword. You'd have legal status for the Dreamers, like Juan Conde, who's a medical student at the University of Vermont, who was brought up here by his mother when he was about 8 years old, and he's studying to be a medical doctor, and he wants to do cancer research, in part in memory of his mother who died of cancer. So these things, I think, have broad support. If we do immigration reform, we can start helping the ag community that desperately needs some folks to help milk the cows. So there's got to be a bipartisan approach on this. And the way it's been operating in the House is we can't get a vote on a bill that has any bipartisan support.
There are lots of issues that we're asking all the candidates about, including a federal minimum wage. You have it stated as one of your campaign platforms. You'd like to see the federal minimum wage raised to $15 an hour. But let me ask you about another issue that you talk about as a candidate, and that is passing what you call common sense gun reforms. Now, your common sense might be different than Joe Schmo's common sense. So what are those gun rights issues and gun control reforms that you would support?
Well, definitely the full background check.
Including for parents and children.
Yes. have a background check. Number two, assault weapons. We don't need those. I mean, those aren't for hunting. And get rid of the gun show loophole. Those are the items. And I think what Vermont did was terrific. And I give Governor Scott real credit for what he did. You know, I went down to Fairhaven after they had that terrible, terrible scare. And what I was inspired by, incidentally, was that the political support for this really has been inspired by kids in high school. And it was really impressive. You know, Bernie and I both went to the March for Our Lives rally in Montpelier, and we stood there as spectators for the entire time and watched and listened to these young people make very compelling statements. And incidentally, they did it with an open mind and understanding that a lot of folks in Vermont use guns properly. So it wasn't about trying to interfere with the responsible use of firearms for hunting or for target shooting, but it was about fundamental safety where they were in jeopardy. So I was very, very inspired by what the kids did.
Now, just to be clear, when you talk about closing the gun show loophole, if there were mandatory background checks, including passing along a gun from a father to his daughter, that would essentially close the gun show loophole just in and of itself, right?
That's correct.
And so you'd support that absolutely mandatory. I mean, that's been a line, mandatory background checks. But then when you come down to it, a lot of candidates differ in what actual universal or mandatory means.
Well, that's true. And frankly, we need the help of some of the responsible gun owners. You know, there's a fear, I think, that if you have any responsible, what I would call common sense gun legislation, gun safety legislation, it means you're going to take away the Second Amendment. And it does not mean that. It does not mean that. But we have to get to a point where I think there's some confidence that the focus here is on gun safety. It's not about taking away the legitimate Second Amendment rights of Vermonters and American citizens.
I just have one very quick question for you, although I'm sorry, it's probably not a quick answer. But Matt in Burlington is very worried about President Donald Trump and says, if you're reelected and he's still around, what will you do to end Donald Trump's presidency?
Well, one of the two reasons I'm running for reelection is to be a voice of opposition to President Trump. And if we're lucky enough to get the majority, we're going to be able to do oversight, have committee hearings where we're getting documents and looking into the policies of the president. And secondly, I'm totally in support of the Mueller investigation. It has to be independent and has to be concluded. And he's gotten three indictments that include the campaign manager for Donald Trump and his national security advisor. He just issued 12 indictments today. So this president is the worst president in my lifetime, by far.
Well, that is Representative Peter Welch running in the Democratic primary for U.S. House, where he hopes to retain his seat in November. Listeners, if you'd like to listen to our interviews with his competitors in the primary, Dan Frylich and Ben Mitchell, you'll find those interviews at vpr.net. Peter Welch, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.